Good morning. On Wednesday at about 4:45, this breaking news.
As you come to us, it's literally breaking in the last few moments on the wires that Israel and Hamas have agreed a provisional outline of a ceasefire deal. That's according to officials being reported across various agencies as well.
And Drive Time brought us immediate reactions of relief from Reham Jafari, Advocacy and Communications Coordinator at ActionAid Palestine.
We welcome this ceasefire that came after 15 months of horrendous and horror and attacks and bombing and suffering caused by relentless bombing for Palestinians' homes, schools, buildings, hospitals in Gaza.
And on Morning Ireland, voices from Tel Aviv. This is Ifat Kaldron, whose cousin Afar is being held hostage.
It's going to be a huge relief. First of all, whenever I see offer. Secondly, whenever I'm going to see the last hostages crossing the border. And we're going to be here protesting every day until it's going to happen. I don't know if we're going to get all of them back home. And it's my huge fear that we're not going to get them all home.
Well, on Thursday's Morning Ireland, Karen Creed got more detail on exactly what was being proposed. She spoke to Greg Carlstrom, Middle East correspondent with The Economist.
Right. Stage one is meant to last for 6 weeks. There'll be 33 Israeli hostages released during that time in dribs and drabs. It should be three on the first day. I think four on the seventh day. They'll be released in stages. In exchange for that, Israel is going to free 30 Palestinian prisoners per hostage. So a total of about 1,000 prisoners over the course of this 6 week agreement. And then along with that, you will have Israeli troops beginning to withdraw from Gaza, not completely pulling out of the territory, but they will pull back to a sort of buffer zone around the edges of Gaza. And then there's a promise that humanitarian aid will significantly increase. There's meant to be 600 trucks a day carrying supplies going into Gaza in the first phase of this deal.
From Thursday's Morning Ireland. But given that this is the same ceasefire that US President Biden had proposed in May, why agreement now? Gavin spoke to Oliver McTiernan, a mediator focused on the Middle East.
It's hard to escape the coincidence of the timing of this agreement with the ending of the Joe Biden presidency and the imminence of the Donald Trump presidency. What impact do you expect that presidency to have on what's going to happen in Gaza?
Gavin, I think the agreement is happening because of the inauguration of Trump. I am absolutely convinced of that. Biden had 15 months in which he could have drawn a line. He said at the beginning, there are no red lines between us and Israel. He's proven that. He's given arms, he's given political support. He's enabled this war to go on. Trump is coming on the scene, I think, wanting to pick up where he left off 4 years ago. His big dream was the Abraham Accords. It was a big dream because it would bring big, big, big bucks to America and to American companies. So I think to get that, he will want to, first of all, have a ceasefire. And I think it's Netanyahu's gift to the new president. Here is your ceasefire. But he will want to go further. I think he will want to see, with the pressure from Saudi Arabia, that there is a permanent peace. And that can only mean the end of occupation and the establishment of a Palestinian state. I don't think there can be any other course of action if we want peace and security in the region.
However, on Thursday morning, there was a setback.
Just this morning, Israel's security cabinet has delayed a planned meeting to approve that ceasefire and hostage deal with Hamas. In the last hour, the office of Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said cabinet will not convene until the mediators notify Israel that Hamas has accepted all elements of the agreement. For the very latest, I'm joined on the line by Sukundar Kermani, who's a foreign correspondent with Channel 4 News. And Sukundar is in Tel Aviv this morning. What do you know about what's going on?
Yeah, all of this really underlining just how fragile this ceasefire is, I think. The disagreement appears to be over a fairly technical part of the agreement. Netanyahu suggesting that Hamas is trying to dictate the exact names of which Palestinian prisoners will be released in exchange for the Israeli hostages, whereas it had been agreed, it seems, that those names would be mutually decided upon. The feeling here seems to be that this is not an insurmountable challenge. The last time, back in November 2023, when there was a ceasefire deal, there were also these kind of last-minute wobbles. But the feeling seems to be that this will go ahead with the ceasefire beginning on Sunday.
And in Israel, resignation threats from government ministers and protesters saying that this ceasefire rewarded Hamas for its actions. Nevertheless, by yesterday afternoon, it seemed clear that yes, this ceasefire would go ahead. However, if anything, there has been an escalation in airstrikes since the announcement of the deal, with the Civil Emergency Service in Gaza saying over 100 people have been killed since the agreement was announced on Wednesday. Claire put this to Lilia Molana Allen, special correspondent at CBS.
These days, the last hours before the ceasefire deal, are the most dangerous. Will you explain that to us? Has it something to do with people being able to see very clearly that the ceasefire has happened? Therefore, in the eyes of the perpetrators, it has to get worse before it gets better.
It's not exactly that. It's that there's now a ticking clock. Right. So in terms of what Israel believes its war goals are, it's now under pressure. This happens every time. I was speaking to people in Gaza the night after the ceasefire deal was agreed, and they were saying, you know, we were out in the street celebrating and then running for cover because the level of attacks that came in that night, that came in last night, again, you know, people are really kind of counting down the clock and saying, God, we've survived more, you know, more than a year of this war. I pray we survived the last 48 hours. That's because the idea here is that now that it's been agreed and the IDF doesn't know if it will be able to continue hitting what it considers its targets, they want to cram in as much as possible into that last period until they are no longer allowed to strike. Because, of course, after Sunday, any strike that takes place will then potentially be considered a violation of the deal.
But for now, aid agencies are poised to get into Gaza and offer what aid they can. And while hopes are high, this peace is fragile. Let's go back to Morning Ireland and this note of caution from Oliver McTiernan.
We saw glimpses in Gaza of the just sheer joy of the thought that the horror, the nightmare was ended. But, you know, looking at the agreement, Gavin, I think it's fraught with risk. It's, for me, a spoiler's dream. Because, you know, there are interests, vested interests. There are people, criminal gangs in Gaza that have been getting extremely rich over the past 15 months. I think they are likely to try and spoil it in the next 6 weeks. And again, there are people in the IDF who are ideologically opposed to any sort of settlement with Gaza, who actually would prefer to settle Gaza, or to have a settlement in Gaza, make it part of Israel. I think they too will be looking for opportunities to derail this agreement.
Oliver, it doesn't sound to me that beyond the first 6 weeks that you believe the ceasefire will last then.
Well, Gavin, my hope is it'll last for the first 6 weeks. I think they're the most difficult, and it's understandable because the starting point is zero trust. So you have this long drawn out protest, one testing the other. Now, the chances of things going wrong in that are very real. Those of us who know Gaza and have lived through, what, five previous wars are very aware of the fact that agreements are made and that they are so easily broken, sometimes intentionally, sometimes unintentionally. So I think it'll be a fraught 6 weeks ahead.
From Morning Ireland yesterday. But if it does hold, it could end the war in Gaza, a war that has killed over 46,000 people. It is hard to know where to go from there, but we'll stay political because at home we have ourselves a government. And on Wednesday, the coalition of Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Regional, Independent, TDs and Kerry's Healy Ray brothers, well, they brought out their draft programme for government. On Morning Ireland, Mary Regan brought us this overview.
By its very nature, I guess, this deal is made up of many compromises to keep, as you described, the four-legged stool stable as can be. And in many respects, the criticism mainly coming from the opposition and, you know, interest groups and campaigners is that this is sort of vague on precise detail, that it's ambitious. But, you know, there's no real timelines into, you know, when things should be carried out. I think it was Jennifer Bray in the Irish Times this morning said explore appears 34 times in the programme for government. There are 86 references to examine, and then there's a lot of, you know, continue to review, aim and assess the possibility or consider doing something. So it's made up of a lot of things that the previous administration had promised but hadn't got around to.
And one area under scrutiny, housing. And on Drive Time, Sarah had quite the over and back with Fianna Fáil TD Derek Cleary on the specifics.
You pledge, as you say, to build over 300,000 homes by the end of 2030. There's no year-by-year breakdown. There's no breakdown on how many will be affordable, how many will be social. In fact, there's just two paragraphs in a 160-page document on housing targets.
There's an entire chapter in this document dedicated to accelerating housing supply, looking at apprenticeships, looking at increasing apprenticeships. We've got to get the skills.
Yeah, I'm talking about
together.
Detail, though. There's a lot of aspiration.
12,500 new apprentices annually. Two-thirds of them are being crafted construction. We're going to strengthen links between education providers and the sector. And we're going to specifically look at permits for getting craftspeople back in, work permits. So it's increasing that level. It's also looking at the housing finance market, which is absolutely crucial. We need 24
I'm
billion
per annum.
I'm going
to bring you back, though, to the headline
I'm answering your question, Sarah. We're going to put 24 billion euro per annum.
The question is, where's the year-by-year breakdown? We're already into almost the end of January, we'll say, by the time this government is in office, and we're being told that you're going to deliver 60,000 homes on average over the next 5 years. There's no year-by-year breakdown, and there's no breakdown of what type.
And we will provide all that. We are looking at 12,000 social homes per annum. We did commencements last year over 40,000. So we're definitely showing evidence of ramping up the ability to deliver those targets.
Well, now, hold on a second. Sorry, on that number that you're after giving me there, there are commencement notices. In terms of the actual delivery, we were told by Micheál Martin and Dara O'Brien in advance of the election that 40,000 homes would be delivered in 2024. And even just last week, we saw new reports coming out saying that it'll be more like 32,000.
Well, look, I'm confident that we will deliver the target of 300,000. As I said, we've put the critical infrastructure in place. We've changed the laws and we're very focused. We've delivered on affordable housing. We're delivering on shared ownership.
Fianna Fáil's Derek Cleary on Drive Time. And as part of the new coalition, Danny and Michael Healy-Ray. And Michael is expecting to be a junior minister in this new government.
I just find it so interesting that you're going in, because it's a big risk for you to take. And I wonder, you know, and I heard you speaking about your father today. He never took that step. You know, do you see what I'm saying? It's just a big risk for you to take, because you're going to have to defend things that you don't like carbon tax increases over the next 5 years.
Well, I'm sorry to correct you, Claire, but maybe you're too young to remember. Jackie Healy-Ray supported governments.
No, that were different. I do remember, but he was never, right. he's never a minister. This is different. It's a big step for you. You have to accept that. It's a big deal.
Of course it is, but we did this in consultation with our five councillors and in conjunction with the group of people who help us throughout the county. They're in every town and in every village, and we listened very carefully to what they wanted. But remember, Jackie Healy-Ray had to vote for austerity measures that were beyond belief. And at the time when the country was in crisis, and indeed when many of the government supporting people were unsteady and unsure, there was a number of independents. And to be honest with you, they were, like Bertie Ahern always said, Jackie Healy-Ray might have been more reliable than a lot of my own people. And because when we shake hands, And when we do an agreement, the one thing that this government will be assured of, we will support them, we will work with them, we will do everything. We're individuals, of course we are, but we're part of a team now, and the team is to work for Ireland.
And on Thursday, ructions, I think it's fair to say, when regional independent TDs supporting the government but not serving as ministers also wanted to form a technical group to sit on the opposition benches and secure Dáil speaking rights. Cue accusations of cakeism. People Before Profits, Richard Boyd Barrett and Fianna Fáil's Niall Collins, well, they went at it on Drive Time.
But is there so not a rule in Parliament that you can't have a technical group if you're within government, a technical group on the opposition bench?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's very clear if you take Danny Healy-Ray, for example, it's his prerogative to support the government. It's his prerogative not to be in government. And he can quite legitimately, in my view, seek to be part of a technical group that will give him...
But he's committed to supporting the programme for government and voting for the government. I mean, it's crazy.
Well,
he's committed to it publicly, Niall.
Sorry, Richard. You're trying to diminish his mandate and you're trying to dismiss him.
Not at all.
Absolutely.
He's taken his mandate into government.
Hang on. Did his brother, Michael Healy-Ray, not say today that they know for sure, he said, if on a handshake, that we will support the government programme?
But that's their choice. What we're speaking about here is the right and the legitimacy of Danny Healy-Ray, for example, to stand up in Dáil Éireann and to give his input into legislation, into whatever the order of business of the day is, and to seek to represent his constituents.
On opposition time.
And he has a mandate to do that. And if he wants to be part of a technical group, and if he can form into a part of it, I don't see an issue with it. It obviously doesn't sit well with Richard Boyd Barrett, the fact that so many people in the in what I would have termed the opposition benches, who independents, the Healy-Rays and the regional independence group, have seen the merit and the positives of the programme for government and have decided to sign up to support
it for
the
government.
But
then the government should then give them the speaking time. Instead, when they're supporting the government, they're part of the government. They shouldn't be trying to steal opposition time and resources and pretending. Standing Orders backs us up on this. Technical groups are formed as part of the opposition. They are now committed to being part of
I'm right on that. So them is the rules. Them is the rules, Niall Collins.
You wouldn't be long back. We leave that there for now. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Wild at Heart, The Straight Story, Twin Peaks, The Late David Lynch, nothing if not a true artist. John Maguire joined Kay on Arena, and it's fair to say, big fan.
Yes, they were violent. Yes, they were strange. Yes, they were surreal. Sometimes he was just baiting you in the audience. But there's a great humanity in all of his work. There are identifiable characters that you really find yourself rooting for in almost every film that he made. Yeah.
And then he did this strange film about him interviewing a monkey in What Jack Did.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, little short. These doodles that he would come out with now and again. These little short things. I mean, he also had a comic strip for a long time called The Angriest Dog in the World, which was just the same four panels in LA Weekly, a magazine in Los Angeles. And he did that for years. Define that for me, Kay. Define any of these things for me. It's almost impossible. And the challenge that you have when you're watching Lynch, I cannot think right now of somebody else in the ecosphere, in cinema, that is asking you to interpret their work in quite the same way, that is deliberately challenging you, presenting you with mysteries, and then abandoning you, leaving you entirely to yourself to figure it out. And that is such an energizing force in cinema, particularly when you're sitting in the audience.
And to be superficial, he had amazing hair.
That is pretty superficial, but he did have amazing hair. Okay, yeah.
Lush
he kept it
and
all
vertical.
Throughout his life. Yeah, all his life, yeah.
And with the Darcy news that a team of international geneticists have found evidence that Iron Age communities in Britain were centred around women, with inheritance in particular down the female line. How's that for an awe? Here's Dr. Laura Cassidy, Assistant Professor at the Department of Genetics at Trinity.
We were looking at one particular site in beautiful, beautiful Dorset, the countryside there. It's a chalk landscape, which is excellent for bone preservation, excellent for DNA. And the University of Bournemouth, they uncovered a cemetery, an Iron Age, late Iron Age cemetery, of many burials, unburnt. That is very rare for Iron Age Britain. So it was really a unique opportunity to look.
They burnt their dead, cremated their dead.
Excarnated, deposited in landscapes. There was a lot of other funerary customs that just aren't as amenable for like DNA studies like these. So we jumped on that opportunity. Don't know what we were expecting at the time, but when the results came up, it was sort of wham in your face that this was an extended family group, but they were all related along the female line. It was female line ancestry that was the foundation of the social organisation of this group.
Will you explain the importance of that for our listeners then?
So, well, that is rare. What this basically is telling us is that in the community, women are staying put through the generations. The line of transmission is from woman to daughter, mother to daughter. But it's not a closed community. There are people coming in and there are people leaving, but they're the husbands, right? So men are marrying into the community and sons are leaving while women are staying put. That is a pattern called matrilocality.
Right. So the women are the anchor tenants, if you like.
Sort of, yeah.
Yes.
And in societies that practice this type of marital
matrilocality.
Custom, matrilocality, okay. New word of the day. when we see, we only have modern matrilocal societies to go by, but if we look at these societies, we see women tend to inherit the land, right? Women have much more opportunity for land ownership, control of resources. They're more active in food production. They're really real players in the local economy and have a lot of control of family finances.
And Ray smashed the patriarchy, Darcy, leapfrogged to this.
So this was this a matriarchy then, as opposed to...
We won't go that far.
Okay, right.
No, so matrilocality does not equal matriarchy. If you're talking about it in the sense of the patriarchy, a matriarchy would be a society where women rule and men are oppressed. That's okay, not okay. what we're talking about
here. Yeah. So what happened then? Why didn't that continue as it was?
Well, I suppose Rome invaded. We can blame the Romans. No, Roman society was much more patriarchal. The head of the household in Rome was the father. When the Romans conquered Britain, they introduced their own customs. They might have melded them a bit with the local customs, but I'm very sure that the Roman invasion would have had a big impact on British women. And then later on, we have Christianity, which doesn't have the best track record with the women.
Trinity's Dr. Laura Cassidy with Ray. And with Brendan at the weekend, two women, Roisin Ingle and her mother Anne. And Roisin has written about being diagnosed with quite serious cancer and how she is living with the news. But initially she was diagnosed with breast cancer, and while a shock, she kind of rolled with it.
Oh, I thought to myself, oh, it's my turn. It happens to a lot of women. And I knew, I believed in that I would have this rough year and then I would be okay. But obviously it was shocking. I'm not going to say, I didn't expect that. I thought I was just doing the right thing and they would say, oh, no, you're grand, you know.
However, they sent her for more scans and she was told that it had spread to her bones and her lymph nodes.
We were now in a different place. That before, I was still kind of clinging on to what they'd said before. I said, no, but you said I'd have a rough year. And she was like, no, it's different now, because this is not something that we can, you know, necessarily cure, but that we can manage. And she said we can manage it for long years is what she said at the time. And it was very shocking. She put some tissues on the desk because, you know, obviously people cry, but I didn't cry. I felt like... Actually, I just felt very nauseous. I was worried I'd have to use the tissues to wipe up my sick off her desk, because that's what the shock did to me. Shock affects people, I suppose, in different ways. And Johnny, my partner, was sitting there as well, and we were both completely shocked. And I think I went back and I told you, Mum, and you. It was a very, I would say, a dark day. I would call it a dark day.
I was absolutely devastated. It was the worst day of my life so far, I think, really. I tried to hold it together while Roisin was there with Johnny. But when she was gone, I just collapsed into tears and I was really, really sad. And I said to my youngest daughter, Katie, I don't want Roisin to die. That's all I could think about. And it was really bad. I mean, that wasn't what I should have been doing, but that's the way it hit me. I was really, really down at the bottom. And I went to bed that night and I didn't sleep and I cried lots more.
And as this new reality began to settle, a revelation of sorts.
we had told the girls I had breast cancer, but we were wondering whether to tell them about this. And then we did do a little bit of Googling because and we decided we would tell them this extra bit of news because we found a lot of teenagers on the internet saying, you think you're helping us by not telling us the whole story, but actually you're making it worse because then we can't trust you. We don't know what's real and what's not real. So we decided we would tell them, but we had a little bit. I think we had an hour before the girls came home from school to kind of get ourselves ready to tell this latest bit. And I remember opening the fridge. This is a big moment of it. And seeing this bottle of wine there, a very nice bottle of wine. And I had this real big sensation that if I could just neck that bottle of wine and then go to bed, that it would all kind of disappear. And I was really visceral. Like it's very, I can feel myself now even back there at the fridge door. But then almost at the exactly same time, I had this other amazing, and I don't know where it came from. I'm not going to get all woo-woo, but it was like a voice or it was like a sensation that actually that would be the worst thing that I could do. And that not only would it be worse, it would make everything worse. And that the really important thing I needed to do from now on was that I had to feel everything. Even though there was going to be really hard feelings,
okay,
I had to feel them in order to be able to deal with what I was going to have to deal with. And that all came very quickly in that moment. And I, actually at that moment, I realised that I was never going to drink alcohol again, because I know that I used alcohol in the past for a long, long time to numb myself from a lot of things and also to celebrate happy things. But a lot of the time, if things were hard, that the wine would help with that. You know, the wine will take the edge off that, will make it better. And it was a massive, I think it was the shock really just shocked me into the realisation that that was absolutely not the right way to go. And numbing it was not the way to go. I had to feel everything. I think that was the beginning of me realising that's how I was going to deal with it.
So they tried to have a good Christmas.
Okay, because bad enough, all of that. And then I was going to a lovely carol service in St. Patrick's Cathedral, which is one of the things we love to do as a family. So on the way, there was a slippery path. I slipped and I broke my ankle. That was on the 18th of December. And then I had to get an operation to get a titanium plates in my ankle because it was quite a bad break. So I was in hospital for 5 days, but I came out on the 23rd of December. And we had a lovely time. It was beautiful, even though I was sitting there in my boot and my crutches and everything. It was great. And I saw then, no, life is still okay. I can manage this. It'll be all right, you know. And that was the beginning of it, I think.
Wow. I'm in awe of that, I have to say, because whatever about everything else, then the ankle happening as well. Like, I'm with your girls. The unfairness of it all.
Fair point. Anyway, she started on her chemotherapy.
I remember texting a friend after that first day, that first chemotherapy infusion, to say, if it's possible to have a nice day in a cancer day ward, I just had one. You know, that's how amazing they made me feel, how safe they made me feel. It's just this care that comes over you. And it's not easy, chemotherapy, as anyone listening who has had it knows. But yeah, they were incredible. So that was hard. And then, of course, I fell down the stairs and did my other leg.
Oh, man. Oh, you should have seen that. It was
terrible. I couldn't tell Mother that for a few days because how can I say I've also done this? Do you remember, Mum?
I do remember very well.
But she is trucking on. She is getting ongoing treatment to stabilise the cancer. She's doing her best to get on with the business of living.
I don't feel like cancer is a sentient thing that is doing something to me. Ha ha, look, I'm going to get Roisin Ingle. Her life is too nice. I'll do this. It doesn't feel like that to me. It feels like, okay, and that acceptance, right, it's been really important.
Okay.
And also the realisation that I have an ability to look at it a certain way and that can reduce the suffering that I have to feel. The way I'm framing it makes it less hard because I've decided to look at it a certain way. And I know that everyone can't do that, yeah, right? But if you can try to do that, if you can realise that this guy, Thich Nhat Hanh, you know him a lot, he's a Buddhist guy, but he talks about us being millions of television channels. And it depends which channel you want to tune into. You can tune into the channel that says everything is terrible and I'm going to have a terrible time. Or you can tune into the one that says life is still full of beautiful things and life is still good.
Roisin Ingle and her mam Anne, all with Brendan at the weekend. Bernard Lynch is a former priest and HIV/AIDS activist. And yesterday he received the Freedom of the City of London. He spoke to Keane on the News at One. And this clip would make your heart sing.
My message is a bit profound, if I may be so egotist. Time is on the side of love. Don't ever give up hope. I mean, hope is not a state of the world presently, as we see. Hope is a state of soul. It doesn't mean that everything will turn out all right. But it does mean that no matter how things turn out, life has a meaning. We all have purpose if we love.
Back in a bit. Welcome back. On Liveline, callers spoke to Joe about the addictive properties of over-the-counter painkillers containing codeine. Their stories were quite shocking. It started on Monday with Mark.
Mark, you were 3 years addicted to codeine.
I was, yeah, true. It was Nurofen Plus, which I was taking. And I started off taking it innocently to treat some back pain, which I had. And then I kind of continued it because the back pain was still there. Okay. And then after a few months, I was like, oh, why am I still taking these? My back is better. And that's when I figured out I couldn't stop.
And where were you getting them?
From the pharmacies, from many, many pharmacies. And I said, as time went on, my use went on and it got worse and it got worse.
But pharmacists are told, anyone who tries to buy Zolpidem or Nurofen Plus or these codeine tablets are told that they're not interrogated, but they're asked a few questions, Andy, for your own use. Use for no more than 3 days. Be very, very careful. So how did you get over that order?
As I said, I just ignored those warnings.
Did you get over the pharmacist counter, so to speak?
As I visited various pharmacies, like I never went to the same pharmacy, in a week, I'd spread it out.
And were you ever refused?
I figured out in my 3 years of addiction that got up to 3 packs a day, so that's 72 tablets. I figured out that I visited in around 2,000 pharmacies. I was refused once.
He went into St. Patrick's in Dublin for 7 weeks.
Like physically, mentally, it was destroying me, absolutely destroying me. And I just didn't know what to do.
Were you a functioning codeine addict? In other words, were you walking, as they say, outside the home?
It was a good question. And I only properly realised the answer to that question once I was in St. Patrick's and started to come down off the codeine. I presumed that it was fine. It wasn't really affecting me all that much, that I was, that I was me. I had this problem. But as my clarity started to come back, once the levels of codeine was being reduced in my body, I didn't realise how much it had changed me as a person, how it had changed my personality. I'd gone from being someone who enjoyed being social, being out, being like enjoying life, to somebody hiding away at home. And just like so ashamed of it that I just found it hard to face people. But I still got on with my life, and I battled it, but I wasn't the person I should have been.
That was Mark on Monday. And on Tuesday, there were a lot of callers with very similar stories. The programme opened with Caroline.
Well, I suppose about 12 to 15 years ago, really, was when I started taking them for a kind of a daily headache, severe enough headache. And somebody just said to me, look, there's a new great painkiller out called Nurofen Plus, give it a go. And I did. And of course, it got rid of the headaches, but it also gave me a kind of a feeling of euphoria, energized, or it calmed me when I was in a very stressful job, and it would calm me down. And I suppose I didn't realize when I started taking it that it was addictive. But, when something has been sold over the counter, you don't really think of it in those terms. Before I realized it, I was addicted to it, and I was eventually taking more and more and increased the dose to about, I would take 3 codeine 4 times a day, and I did that for years and years. It's a very secretive addiction. I was codding myself and I was codding everyone around me. I was afraid not to take it.
And she talked about the lengths she would go to get those tablets.
You just become ruthless about getting it, and you just travel to get them. Once you wear out your welcome in your local pharmacies, you'll get in your car and you'll like, because I tried to get off them on my own by going cold turkey several times.
Okay.
And it's horrific. Like the come down is absolutely horrific. It's like the worst flu you can possibly imagine.
And as the calls came in, similar stories of initial relief from pain, and then quite quickly, dependence. Here's Lisa.
I began to take Solpadeine almost 22 years in March, actually. Mm-hmm. When I had my youngest child, came home from hospital, took them for backache. But anyway, here I am nearly 22 years later and still taking 8 every day of the week.
Oh, good God.
I spoke to my GP about it. They referred me to a hospital with a methadone program. You hear the word methadone and you kind of don't want to associate yourself with, oh God, you know, some unfortunate who has a really, really bad addiction. Yeah. And then there's the realisation that it's just a different name. I'm the same person, really. It's a drug addiction, do you know?
And she's tried to come off them, but it hasn't worked.
I wouldn't go through that again. That was worse than I've had three kids.
What was worse? Explain it to me. What was worse?
The symptoms, they're so frightening, Joe.
The withdrawal symptoms.
Really, really terrifying symptoms. Your hands trembling, your heart racing, like a panic attack, perpetual panic attack. Almost like you're not in control of your own body. It's horrible, horrible weakness, a fatigue. But your mind is racing, but your body is slowing down, profusely sweating. The physical symptoms of trying to come off it made me realise that I was addicted to it. Do you know?
Yeah.
And it was embarrassing. It really was embarrassing. And I went back on them. And here I am still.
And then Jason, who had been addicted to codeine for 10 years. He started taking Solpadeine for back pain.
I'd never taken them before. And then when I took them, it was like euphoria, you know?
Yeah.
You were constantly chasing that euphoric sensation. And you were just taking more and more and more and more and more. Chemists were refusing me and saying, no, you're taking way too much. And I drove the country to get them.
And finally, Niamh. She'd become addicted to Nurofen Plus and had done some really serious damage to her kidneys.
When I was at my worst, I was taking 3 packs of 24 a day. So I was taking 72 tablets. I was taking 24 just to get out of the bed in the morning, 24 in the afternoon, 24 in the evening. I had gone to the state that none of the pharmacists in my town would serve me. So I was going out of town driving around to see where I could get it. I stopped paying my mortgage, stopped paying my bills. I had gone from the buzz was gone. There was no buzz anymore. This was just literally to stop the withdrawals, to get me through the day.
Yeah.
To just be able to survive, to mind my kids, look after my house. I've been on a methadone program now for the last 8 years. And that methadone has saved my life because I was getting to the stage that I was going looking for something else because I just couldn't get through the day anymore.
Without
and I couldn't get Nurofen Plus. I don't think people realise the dangers when they go into the chemist.
But when,
from Liveline this week. No, I shouldn't be telling you this. Sworn to secrecy, but sure you won't tell anyone. It's unbelievable. Wait till you hear. Secrets and gossip and secret keepers. There are those that can keep them and those that cannot. Reporter Emer McCauley went out to ask people just how sealed their lips were.
Are you someone who can be trusted with a secret?
100%. I love secrets.
Do you think that married couples can be trusted to keep secrets?
I think always going to tell my partner. Sorry.
There's been a few occasions where a friend told me something and specifically told me not to
tell you. Okay, yeah. Do you think that gossip is a healthy thing?
Up to a certain point, it's great. And it's just part of the colour, the tapestry of life.
Maybe we're not gossipers, we're just storytellers.
Yeah, storytellers. Yeah, I like that.
I'm exceptionally good at keeping.
Really good at keeping.
I'm Northern.
Where are you from, the North?
Can't say.
Yeah. I get told secrets.
It depends, doesn't it? Yeah, it is. If it was my sister saying, don't tell anyone, I'm going to go straight to my brother or my mother. Yeah, we're brothers and sisters, so it'd be straight to my mum.
Straight on the phone, ringing my mother. Mum, you'll never believe what's happened. Have a guess what?
And joining Claire, Aileen Hickey and clinical psychologist Dr. Eddie Murphy. And Aileen, well, tell her a secret and expect to be hearing it back, maybe within the hour.
If somebody says to me, can I tell you a secret? Are you going to keep it secret? I say, absolutely not. I'm absolutely hopeless. You can tell me because I'd love to know the secret. But there's absolutely no chance that I'm going to be able to keep it.
And not only can she not keep a secret, she's not above a bit of embellishment.
I told a secret you know, when I was in college to somebody, and the secret was, and I told her not to tell anybody else, that my father was first cousin of Elvis Presley. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously it wasn't true, but by the time I left college, everybody in college thought that I was first cousin of Elvis Presley, so she obviously didn't keep the secret. Now, on the other hand...
Why did you tell your friend that?
Because I was big into Elvis Presley, and everybody kept asking me why I was so big into Elvis Presley. The only reason I was big into Elvis Presley was actually because Winnie had one record at home, and every Sunday there was an Elvis Presley movie on the television. That's actually the only reason I was into Elvis Presley, but it was easier to say that, and I thought it was a great thing to say. The other thing, though, that...
Okay, but when it comes to lies, this is how to spot them. Take it away, Doc.
You can't tell if someone's lying, because obviously there can be inconsistencies in their story. They sometimes avoid direct answers. There could be a change in their speech pattern, or they could have non-verbal cues, like they might shake their head instead of nodding their head when they're saying yes, and facial expressions.
But if you, or indeed your little darling, is a shameless, bare-faced liar, I wouldn't worry about it. You're probably really smart.
Is there a personality type, Eddie, around this? You know, somebody who can keep a secret and somebody who can't?
Well, people that are good at lying are basically people that have a high cognitive ability. You know, they're bright, that they have good emotional control and life experiences. Often these are the make people effective liars, but also effectively able to hold secrets, and that they're quick thinking. They're able to if you look at the traitors, which we're all semi obsessed with, and look at they're able to to hold a believable story, but they have to be quick thinking. So some of that comes from confidence, charisma, manipulation. They're the type of things, and that relates to a level of intelligence.
Do we have to be wary
but
of people
that
who
to
are
your behaviour?
Yeah, people who are good, say on the traitors, and I am one of those who is absolutely addicted to it. But I'm watching them sitting around the round table in particular. You know, in the cold light of the cross examination, if you like, and denying that they're traitors when they are. And I can't figure out how they do it and keep a straight face. But you know, is there a particular skill that you learn in being able to do that?
Well, there's a great experiment that psychologists do with children. So to look at their capacity to tell a lie. And so what happens is we put a desired tie out on the table, and then we pretend to get called out of the room, and it's behind the child, or it's under it, and under maybe a piece of cloth. Say, now, I got called out now, please don't look at that. And there's, of course, cameras on the kids and stuff like that. And it was done between aged around 3 to 7. And then you walk out and you see that the kid will have a little peek and stuff like that. And you come back in and say, oh, did you get a chance to look at that? And as you get older, that 6 or 7 year old say, yeah, or the 3 year old say, oh, I did look at, sorry. Mm. And the 7 year old go, no, I didn't look at that. Well, you know, they have looked at that, right? But actually, that's just a real sign of intelligent child, actually, you know.
Oh, is it?
It shows a sort of a,
So does, good liars are brighter than honest people.
Yeah, I'm very worried that Eddie's calling me stupid here. Those kind of lines. And actually, my self-esteem, Eddie, has dropped significantly in the last 5 minutes.
We'll definitely have to book that session in then.
And that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening, and for the week that's in it. We can only end with the Nolan sisters.